Here's 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington. Harlem in the 1920s was unlike any other place in America. In a piece published in Crisis magazine, poet Langston Hughes describes what Harlem was like in 1926.
Harlem and its love nights, its cabarets and casinos, its dark, warm bodies. The thundering subways, the arch of the bridges, the mighty rivers hold me. I am amazed at the tremendousness of the city, its diverseness, its many, many things. I cannot tell the city how much I love it. I have not enough kisses in my mouth for the avid lips of the city. I become dizzy dancing to the jazz-tuned nights, ecstasy wearied in the tired days. The fascination of this city is upon me, burning like a fire in the blood.
That was 1A producer Morgan Givens reading Langston Hughes' description of New York's Harlem neighborhood in the mid-1920s. It's been nearly a century since the Harlem Renaissance, and while artists like Louis Armstrong, Langston Hughes, and Zora Neale Hurston still endure, dozens, if not hundreds of works from that period have been lost or forgotten or, in some cases, never even published. Well, now, many of those are coming to life for the very first time. This week, a never-before-published novel by Jamaican-born poet Claude McKay was published 90 years after it was written. And another novel by writer Jesse Fassett was also republished this week for the first time in nearly 100 years. Well, why are these forgotten works resurfacing now? And how do they change our understanding of this cultural movement? Joining me from St. Louis Public Radio is William Maxwell, professor of English and African American Studies at Washington University in St. Louis. Professor Maxwell, great to have you.
Good day. This is Professor Maxwell. And from the city in which Langston Hughes was inspired to write The Negro Speaks of Rivers about 100 years ago, actually.
That's wonderful. And so great to have you joining us from that place as we talk about the Harlem Renaissance. And joining from NPR in that very city of New York is Morgan Jenkins, author of This Will Be My Undoing, Living at the Intersection of Black, Female, and Feminist in White America, senior editor of Zora Magazine. Morgan, welcome to you.
Thank you so much. It's Morgan Jerkins.
Jerkins. Oh, thank you.
It happens all the time.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much. Also joining from NPR in New York is Autumn Womack, assistant professor of 19th and 20th century African American literature at Princeton University. Professor Womack, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Morgan Jerkins, you wrote in the introduction to Jesse Fassett's novel, There Is Confusion, which was republished just yesterday. Who was Jesse Fassett, and why has she largely disappeared from the conversation about the Harlem Renaissance?
Yes, so Jesse Fassett, I would say, was just a multi-hyphenate artist. And she was a poet, she was an essayist, she was the literary editor of The Crisis between 1919 and 1926 under the stewardship of W.E.B. Du Bois. And she also was a mentor. I mean, she published Langston Hughes' first poem, The Negro Speaks of Rivers. She mentored County Cullen, Jean Toomer, Claude McKay. And it's fascinating and also sad in a sense that she was lost to public imagination, I would say, for many different factors. And I think one of it is because she was a woman, a black woman, and she often was overshadowed by her black male counterparts.
Hmm. Well, Morgan, in a piece that you wrote for The New Yorker, you talk about a dinner that took place in downtown New York, 1924. Now, this dinner largely considered to be the event that led to the beginning, the spawning of the Harlem Renaissance. Take a minute. Take us inside that dinner. Tell me who was there, who was around the table, and also what happened that was pivotal for Jesse Fassett.
Oh, man. So that dinner was legendary in a sense that it was just a who's who of black luminaries and also white people there as well. But anyone you can think of that, you know, they were at that dinner to celebrate black authors. But the word was that that dinner was supposed to be in celebration of Jesse Fassett's debut novel, There Is Confusion. She was told by Charles Johnson, who at that time was leading Opportunity magazine, that it was going to be in honor of her. Well, the problem got what happened was because Alain Locke, who was also considered one of the midwives of the Harlem Renaissance, by Langston Hughes' words, he was the master of ceremonies. And he did not like Jesse Fawcett at all. To this day, I'm not sure why, because they were both very educated black people that carried himself in a certain way.
Claude McKay liked Jesse Fawcett. I just want that known by the
time. Oh, okay. Yes. Please note that.
They were aesthetically completely different. But
yes,
she was really kind to him, took him out to dinner, which he desperately needed. So thank you, Jesse Fawcett.
Yes, yeah. And he did not like her. It was a very sharp disdain. So because he was the master of ceremonies, instead of centering Jesse Fawcett, he made it just a general celebration of black writers. And it wasn't until years later that Fawcett actually wrote a scathing letter to Locke about how the party was actually intended for her. So this sort of overlooked aspect, I would say, in retrospect, was a harbinger of things to come, even in the afterlife.
So this was her party, and in a way, he didn't even invite her.
Well, no, she was there.
Oh, I know.
No, she was there.
I know she was there, but she wasn't honored, is what I mean to say. She wasn't invited into the circle. I mean, she was excluded.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, Professor Maxwell, you've already put in your vote for Claude McKay and the way he treated Jesse Fawcett.
Now, it's a shock, I know. I have someone else we could talk about.
No,
yes, Claude McKay
I want
is
you to,
indeed my favorite.
I want you to talk about Claude McKay because you're the co-editor of Romance in Marseille. That's a novel. Mm-hmm. By Claude McKay. It was published for the first time also yesterday. Now, McKay is maybe another lesser-known writer of the Harlem Renaissance. So who was he, and why was Claude McKay important?
Well, the first thing I'd like to say is the reason, other than the fact that Claude McKay wrote this book between 1929 and 1933, that we have it today is because of my co-editor, Gary Holcomb, who for... This is not an exaggeration, about 20 years pressed to get this into publication. But who was Claude McKay? I think it's fair to say he is, if not the most radical writer of the Harlem Renaissance, certainly one of them. And you can measure that on a traditional political spectrum, the one that we inherit from the French National Assembly. He's the furthest to the left of all the Harlem writers. He's a very important early black communist. And he would be important in the history of 20th century ideology, political life, if he never wrote a sonnet. So he's quite radical politically. He also becomes one of the first black anti-Stalinists. So he breaks with the Soviet version of communism in advance of the generation of Richard Wright and Ralph Ellison, who are more famous for that break, who wrote major novels around it. He's radically international. He's born in the Clarendon Hills of Jamaica in 1889, migrates to the United States pretty much the first moment he can, winds up at the Tuskegee Institute, hates what he sees as the militarized culture there, moves to Harlem, but significantly leaves Harlem just as the Harlem Renaissance is really taking off. And this might be one reason for his relative marginality, though he's very much back in vogue in the best ways. So 1923 comes around. He's just written the first significant book of poetry from the Harlem Renaissance, which is called Harlem Shadows. And he gets on a boat and he works as a stoker and he's trying to get himself to Europe and then eventually to Moscow for a meeting of the Comintern.
Why did he leave just when things in Harlem for an artist were really starting to hum? Was he over it all? Was it not for him? Or did he just have travel in his blood?
He was over it all. I think that he would have been invited to the famous 1924 dinner that we were just talking about, but I think he probably would have felt pretty badly afterwards and may not have attended in the first place. I mean, he was a hardcore bohemian. He wanted a Renaissance that was based on both absolute truth-telling and on the unmediated culture of black working-class people themselves, where he always located wisdom. So he was always skeptical of the desire to use the Harlem Renaissance as essentially a form of black middle-class uplift politics, which is not to say that everyone else in the Harlem Renaissance was interested in that, but some of the grandees, some of the great entrepreneurs, Alain Locke, W.E.B. Du Bois, James Weldon Johnson, and others were certainly in that camp.
And he was a communist, so... Maybe he objected also. Look, a Harlem Renaissance also meant a certain degree for some writers, commercial success. I might guess he might have disapproved of that.
Well, he wanted more commercial success than he found, believe me. But he does argue in public and private with Du Bois about both ideological and aesthetic matters. And, you know, Du Bois writes the most scathing review of McKay's career, in which he talks mm-hmm. about a novel that was published in 1928, Home to Harlem, probably McKay's most notable work, at least, you know, in contemporary times, and says, after reading its pages, I feel distinctly like taking a bath. Mm. McKay wrote him a very scathing personal letter after that. So there's a lot of back and forth. It's not just political, that's important, but there are also aesthetic matters that separate them.
Artists having their debates and their conflicts, especially back then. Well, we've talked about some of these lesser known writers, Jesse Fassett, Claude McKay. But here's writer Alice Walker, by the way, talking about a Harlem Renaissance figure that many people probably have heard of.
I think my junior year in high school, that was the year that Zora died. And I had no idea she had ever lived. I had never heard of Zora Neale Hurston. I had no idea, none, that there were black women writers.
There's Alice Walker talking about Zora Neale Hurston, a writer who Alice Walker helped revitalize in the 1970s. Well, Professor Womack, Zora Neale Hurston is an interesting figure because most people have heard of her now, but she died largely in obscurity until, as I said, Alice Walker kind of revived her legacy in the 70s. So why did she receive so little acclaim while she was alive? And then why did that change?
So she actually received quite a bit of acclaim while she was alive in the earlier part of the what we think of as the Harlem Renaissance. So the late 1920s and the 1930s. I mean, she was quite a well-known and prominent person, artist, anthropologist, personality in the Harlem Renaissance. There's a couple of different reasons, I think, why she died in obscurity. I mean, one of the reasons is that she ran out of money. And so she claims that many people did too, that at the onset of the Great Depression, a lot of the patronage dried up that was driving and funding these black writers in the Harlem Renaissance. She also wrote in a style that was not entirely conventional, right? So she was really dedicated to capturing the vibrancy and the pulse and the dynamism of black Southern culture, performance, voice, sound. So while many writers in this time period were turning their attention to New York and to urban centers, she was really intent on locating the subject of her writing in the black South, although she did write some stories about the North and about New York that have been recently recovered, if we're talking about lost texts. Many people think that what was thought of as our conservative views around segregation led to her drop in popularity. Mm. So she was not entirely in favor of the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education decision, not because she thought that blacks didn't deserve equal education, but she didn't think it should be funneled through white institutions, right? I mean, she grew up in an all-black town, and she was very proud of that and committed to the idea that the institutions should be equal on their own terms.
Well, let's listen to Zora Neale Hurston in her own voice.
Wake up, bullies, get on the rock, tink quiet, Davis, 5 o'clock. Come up on that cover, bullies, come on up on that cover, unless you want some trouble with the walker, come on. Wake up, Jacob.
Well, Professor Autumn Womack, in a 2018 essay in the Paris Review, journalist Chantal Tattley described Hurston this way: a mudslinging proto-feminist novel folklorist, playwriting ethnographer, not to be crossed. Now, that is a whirling description. Mm-hmm. What was she like in life?
I mean, she was a master of reinvention. She was constantly negotiating all of these different spheres and places and geographic domains. I mean, we hear her voice, right? She had a strong voice both on the page and in writing. I mean, there's very many accounts of her walking into spaces in Harlem and a very performative nature, right? She was committed to the stage. She was committed to black theater. She was committed to embodied performance, to dance, to movement. She did a ton of field research in the American South, and she lived amongst the people that she wrote about. I mean, this was her community. So, I mean, in her autobiography, Dust Tracks on the Road, she talks about, you know, living in turpentine camps and getting in fights with people and, you know, having to go undercover to duck and dive and move through all of these important and interesting scenarios. So I think that that characterization of her as being kind of extraordinary is right on point. Mm.
Well, Professor Maxwell, back on Claude McKay, he introduced a number of openly queer characters, which was revolutionary for the time. We're going to take a break, but take just a minute. Talk quickly about the subculture around Harlem, artists who wanted to explore not just race, but gender, class, sexuality, things that a lot of people were not writing about.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you could say that that subculture is continuous with the whole second generation of Harlem Renaissance writers. We're not just talking about McKay, who actually worked with Zora Neale Hurston and Gwendolyn Bennett and Richard Bruce Nugent and others on some smaller publications. McKay himself was a kind of mediator of various subcultures. He brings together gay and lesbian subculture in New York City. He's a fairly openly bisexual man during this period. He hooks that culture up with the black radical culture, the proto-communist culture of Uptown, the Jamaican radicals who were so important in the Harlem Renaissance, people like Cyril Briggs. He hooks that culture up with downtown lyrical left culture, the magazines The Masses, The New Masses, The Liberator, Crystal Eastman, Max Eastman. So I would say he's somebody who cements these various sexual and political subcultures together almost single-handedly during this period.
Well, Joan tweeted this. I took a college course on African-American literature in the early 70s at West Virginia University. It introduced me to authors I would not have met otherwise, and for that, I'm grateful. We're talking about the Renaissance of the Harlem Renaissance. William Maxwell, professor of English and African-American studies at Washington University in St. Louis. Morgan Jerkins and Autumn Womack are here as well. We'll take a pause and we'll talk a lot more about the Harlem Renaissance in just a moment. I'm Todd Zwillick. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Uber. Uber is committed to safety and to continuously raising the bar to help make safer journeys for everyone. For starters, all drivers are background checked before their first ride and screened on an ongoing basis. And now, Uber has introduced a brand new safety feature called Ride Check, which can detect if a trip goes unusually off course and check in to provide support. To learn more about Uber's commitment to safety, visit uber.com/safety.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or perfect strangers? Get the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle so you can share what you know. On the News Roundup, find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
What's good, y'all? As you know, February is Black History Month, and all throughout that month, NPR's Code Switch is going to be running a special series about the history of Black resistance. Because as long as Black folks have been oppressed in this country, which is, you know, forever, we've also been fighting back. Listen and subscribe.
Well, let's get back to our discussion about the Harlem Renaissance, authors whose work has been lost, and this Renaissance of the Renaissance. Let me set the scene for you once again to get us back into the spirit. Here's probably a person reading a poem that maybe you've probably heard of.
I've known rivers ancient as the world and older than the flow of human blood in human veins. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawns were young. I built my hut near the Congo and it lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans, and I've seen its muddy bosom turn all golden in the sunset.
That was Langston Hughes reading probably one of his most famous poems, The Negro Speaks of Rivers. Morgan Jerkins is here, Autumn Womack is here, and William Maxwell of Washington University in St. Louis is here as well. In 2018, Hurston's book, Barracoon, about one of the last Africans to be brought over to America through the illegal slave trade, was published for the very first time almost a century after it was written. Now, Professor Womack, Zora Neale Hurston, she really struggled with the story that would become Barracoon. Why was writing this story such a hard time for her?
So she began to write the story that would become Barracoon in 1927. So that was the first time that she had gone down south on a research trip sponsored by Carter G. Woodson and Franz Boas, who was her professor at Columbia University, where she was studying anthropology as a student at Barnard. So she began to write it in 1927. She returned in 1928, 29 to spend more time with him to create a more full-length version. And then she moved across different genres. So she, in her letters to various folks, including one of her patrons, Charlotte Osgood Mason, she said, I'm going to try my hand at putting his story in a series of parables. She tried recording him, right? So maybe film would be the medium that would best tell this story. So one of the things that's about this is very characteristic of Hurston is that she was always looking for the right form to tell this story of Black life. Right. And in particular, this subject of slavery, it seems, posed a particular challenge for her as she was trying to figure out a form that would tell this story about a thing that's supposed to be in the past. Right. But that's still ongoing. So there's this temporal kind of tangle that she was struggling with and grappling with. And I think what's really beautiful is in her movement across these forms, we really see the impossibility of ever telling the story of slavery as something that's in the past, right? And that's something that, I mean, contemporary scholars talk about in terms of the afterlife of slavery, but she was theorizing this, I think, in her movement across forms and trying to get it right and struggling to tell this story in a way that conveys the complexity.
And you've written about how she struggled almost from a scientific perspective, her background as an anthropologist and wanting to give her subject his voice in telling his story, not being too emotionally involved in it. At the same time, how can you not be? And right. sort of that history telling, narrative writing, but scientific approach is a tough one to navigate.
Right. And I mean, the thing that's so brilliant about Hurston is that she figured out her own way to do it. Right. So she was like, there is no way that I can be a totally detached, objective observer of this cultural life that I am a part of. So she totally rejected this idea of scientific objectivity. Right. And she also spent so much time with this man. I mean, she went to his house and she talks about how she brought him fruit, how they became friends, how she took photographs of him. Right. And so really refusing that binary of subject and researcher and thinking holistically about how do I approach this as a human, right, and as a story that we all need to hear as opposed to an object of knowledge.
Morgan Jerkins, I want to ask you about Jesse Redmond-Fassett again. You mentioned that she wrote about the Black middle class. She wrote about upwardly mobile Black people during the Harlem Renaissance, and she caught a lot of criticism from other Black artists for focusing on this slice of Black life. Now, Professor Maxwell made it clear that Claude McKay was nice to her, and despite the fact that he was a communist,
she was nicer to him, I would say. She spent more money on his dinner. Anyway, no, she was very kind to younger writers, even those who were quite politically and artistically opposed.
Well, so. Morgan Jerkins, what about Jesse Fassett and this writing about the Black middle class? Did she catch a lot of heat for it? How did she navigate that?
I mean, it was hard. I mean, you have to understand that the Harlem Renaissance, like, even though there was a lot of Black people creating at the time, there were a lot of opinions, oftentimes controversial ones, about how to write about Black people. So as Professor Womack talked about with Zora Neale Hurston, she wrote about Black Southern people with regards to their dialect and their vibrancy, and she often caught flack from other people like Richard Wright, for example. For Jesse Fassett, you have to understand she was from South Jersey. She was Ivy League educated. She came from, I would say, like Black intelligentsia people from South Jersey and Philadelphia. And so she wrote of these people often in the style of what some would consider today, like Jane Austen, for example. Some people liken There Is Confusion to Jane Austen's work. And some people had a problem with that because they said, you know, that doesn't really represent Black people as a whole. And now we have this time, we're in the spotlight now. Why aren't you speaking to a larger swath of Black people? But she wanted to write about what she knew and explore the complexities right there.
Can I leap in and say something?
That
comment is really productive and interesting to me. I mean, one thing that we can say about the Harlem Renaissance, which is really difficult to define, is that it's a moment when African-American artists make it very clear that there isn't a singular black identity.
Right. Exactly.
Right? That, you know, African-Americans, indeed people from, you know, the African diaspora come from every kind of region, from every kind mm-hmm. of sociological position, from mm-hmm. every kind of ethnicity, speak every kind of language you can imagine. Mm-hmm. It's like you can't define the central style of the Harlem Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right? It sponsors work in all these different modes.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating. Well, we heard a little bit from Langston Hughes at the very top, and I did that for a reason because I want to get back to Langston Hughes and his relationships with some of the artists that we're talking about today.
Yeah.
Here we go. Now, everybody's excited. Let's hear from Langston again, though. We heard a little bit from Negro Speaks of Rivers. Here's a clip from that same recording, Langston Hughes explaining the inspiration behind the poem. Listen.
The Negro Speaks of Rivers, one of my earliest poems, written in 1920, just after I came out of high school. I was going to Mexico to visit my father, who lived in Mexico City, and on the train going across the Mississippi River, I looked out the window and I saw this great muddy river flowing down toward the heart of the South, and I began to think about what this river meant to the Negro people.
Now, Professor Womack, Zora Neale mm-hmm. Hurston and Langston Hughes were very good friends, right?
Yes.
They had
until they weren't.
Okay. Oh no. You sound like you were prepared for that question.
No, they were until they weren't. Yes.
Oh well, right. Okay. Exactly. They were until they weren't. They both. So this is complicated. They both had what was referred to, what might be referred to as a patron, a white patron. Mm-hmm. Then the relationship between them got complicated. So I know you've been waiting for this one. Tee it up.
So they had a really lovely, enduring friendship, which I think is important to highlight. There's a beautiful book out now that tracks their friendship called Zora and Langston, or Langston and Zora. I apologize for not getting the title entirely correct right now. So they were the best of friends. I mean, there's beautiful correspondence between them. When Hurston was on a research folklore collecting trip in the late 1920s, I mean, she would write to him. She would say, I'm finding things for you. I'm collecting. I've been sharing your book. I've been giving out copies of it, of his poetry. I've been reading it. So they were really committed to fostering each other's personal success. Mm-hmm. They also, as you said, they shared one white patron, Charlotte Osgood Mason. And they had different terms of their contract and they had different relationship with her. And that might have had, it definitely had something to do with the fracture. But it really, I mean, as the legend goes, it all came to a head when they were working on this play, Mulebone, together. Mm-hmm. And they were supposed to collaborate. And maybe this is a lesson in the difficulty of collaborating with best friends. But the legend has it that Hurston submitted a copyright for the play with her name alone. Then there is all this drama, the triangulation of the person who was working with them as well. The play never actually got staged because everybody got turned off by the drama of it all. Hughes felt like he was blocked out of it. Hurston said, that's not true. I didn't try to do that. And from there, things went from bad to worse. Mm-hmm.
One listener tweeted this. What a great conversation on the writers of the Harlem Renaissance. Thank you. I knew a little about some of these writers, but you are really going in depth with the knowledgeable experts. I will listen again and read more of these writers' works. I agree. We've got great experts who really wanted to lean in on the relationship also between Zora Neale Hurston and Langston Hughes. I'm Todd Zwillick. You're listening to 1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor LegalZoom. LegalZoom can help make sure your small business is set up for success this year. LegalZoom has helped more than 2 million Americans incorporate, form an LLC, and more. You can also get advice on contracts, lease agreements, and other legal questions through LegalZoom's network of independent attorneys, since they're not a law firm. More information is available at LegalZoom.com/NPR.
There's more to watch and read these days than any one person can get to. That's why we make Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Twice a week, we sort through the nonsense, share reactions, and give you the lowdown on what's worth your precious time. Listen and subscribe to NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour.
This is 1A. We're talking about the Harlem Renaissance and Langston Hughes. Professor Womack, why has Langston Hughes endured as one of the most widely read and recognized figures from the Harlem Renaissance when so many other writers, as we've been talking about, have either peaked and then receded or never been published in the first place?
I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with the gender aspect that Morgan brought up in the beginning. I mean, it's not coincidental that Jesse Fawcett and Nella Larsen, right, and Hurston to a certain extent have kind of fallen by the wayside. I mean, Hughes was a masterful poet and writer. I mean, that's part of it. I mean, he produced an amazing output. The output, though, I think is a large part of it. I mean, he produced a ton of poetry and prose. He traveled internationally in a different way than somebody like Hurston. So he had a different kind of global footprint, which also had a lot to do with it. He had a different kind of financial support. So Hurston was really financially dependent on Mason for a while. Hughes had a different number of fountains of funds and money. Hurston also kind of had an embargo on the production of her work. So as part of her contract with this patron, she was not able to publish anything, although she did. She skirted it and got in trouble. So there was a moment where she couldn't actually put out as much work as Hughes did. So those are some of the reasons. I mean, he also just was, I mean, people loved him, right? In a way that I think all of the figures that we're talking about today had a different... They rubbed against the institutional norm in a way that I think was a little grating for some folks.
Morgan, let's talk about Jesse Fawcett a little bit more, and there is confusion. You've said that it raises questions that still feel urgent today. Does a black artist have to reflect the larger ideals of his or her community? Is individuality reserved only for white people? And I think Professor Maxwell kind of got at this, the leeway that a black artist has to write about broader classes of people than people want her to write about. Is that a challenge for you? Do you still feel it today?
Absolutely. When people ask me, who do you write for? I often wonder if they're asking me that because I'm thinking, should I answer like I'm writing for the little girl, you know? Or are they asking me that because they know and I know that the publishing industry is still white dominated and there's only a certain few that get through that door? And when you get through that door, what are you going to do with it? Are you going to leave it open? Are you going to close it? And so when I think about this idea of individuality and cultural obligation, I try to find a balance with it, but I also have to remind myself it's still a business and not everyone has the same opportunities and privileges as myself. And how do you contend with that while also trying to write just what you want to write? I don't think you can always do that because we don't live in an equal world.
Can I say something about that on the question of business in the Harlem Renaissance? I mean, I don't think it's ignoble to suggest, I believe this is the truth, that one of the things the Harlem Renaissance permitted was better business relationships between younger, talented black writers, many of whom were drawn to New York City because it was the center of American publishing, and really important emerging publishing firms like Alfred A. Knopf and Gordon Liveright and others. And people like Alain Locke, for all their, you know, difficulty with some of the younger generation, made contracts happen, right? There was a marketing wing of the Harlem Renaissance, which, again, is not an ignoble thing. This is what a modern Renaissance requires. It requires a commercial presence.
It requires readers, and it requires people willing to buy a book. Well, we have to go, and I'm sorry to say it, because I know listeners are loving this conversation. Just one second. Autumn Womack, I'll leave it to you. We've been talking about so many authors. just give me one recommendation. If people are interested in the Harlem Renaissance, they want to catch up on the history, who should they read? What's out right now?
A writer from the Harlem Renaissance or a contemporary?
Anything you want. Give us one idea.
I know the correct answer.
Is that the correct answer? Can I say two things that I think would give a full picture of the Harlem Renaissance?
We have time for one.
I would say Lane Locke's The New Negro Anthology, and then Fire, which was Hurston and Coe's renegade kind of response to it, which is like the radical younger voices saying anti-institutional
all black.
Fantastic. People should catch up on those titles that Autumn Womack has recommended if they want to get more out of this new renaissance of the renaissance. That's Autumn Womack, assistant professor of 19th and 20th century African American literature at Princeton. Thank you so much, Professor.
Thank you.
Morgan Jerkins, senior editor at Zora Magazine. Morgan, thanks to you.
Thank you.
And Professor William Maxwell at Washington University in St. Louis. Professor, thanks to you as well.
Thanks for the opportunity. It was a real pleasure.
Great to have all of you. This conversation was produced by Haley Blassengame and edited by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the website at the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU. It's part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Todd Zwillich. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.